Today we have a show I've been looking forward to for a long time. We're going to have one of our favorite guests returning to talk about his new book. Our guest will be Norman Solomon, author of the brand new book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. We'll have Norman Solomon on the air for the full hour talking with us today, taking your calls. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. But first, before we go to Norman Solomon, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The Federal Communications Commission was once again in the hot seat up on Capitol Hill this week. The House held a hearing to address concerns about the results of the recent auction of public airwaves. One big problem is that giant telecom companies Verizon and AT&T won most of the prized 700 megahertz spectrum, which will be used for wireless services. Here's Congressman Ed Markey.
There is no new national competitor to provoke new broadband competition, innovation, and consumer choice coming out of the auction.
Markey said that a previous FCC decision to do away with caps on how much spectrum a company could bid for has proven to be a mistake.
Spectrum caps had ensured that incumbents couldn't gobble up all of the available spectrum and effectively box out would-be competitors from reaching the market.
Some Republican members of the committee were upset that the auction, which brought an unprecedented $19 billion into the Treasury, didn't make as much money as it could have. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin defended the requirements as a way to foster new innovation.
I think that we end up having to put auction rules in place that balance a variety of public interest factors and that raising money alone is not our sole goal.
Harold Feld, Senior Vice President of the Media Access Project, who also testified at the hearing, agreed.
The tragedy of our spectrum policy is that it has been reduced to four words. Show us the money.
Feld says that's not the way it's supposed to be.
The public interest goals that were laid out by Congress in 1993 when it first adopted the spectrum auction statute tell us that we deserve a world in which everyone has access to wireless opportunities, to the economic advantages that wireless technologies can bring, and in particular, women and minority-owned businesses and rural businesses, which for historic reasons have been denied access to capital or licenses, deserve a fair shake in these auctions.
Markey agreed.
We all have to be concerned by this. We all have to ensure that we include more minorities and women in the future of telecommunications for the 21st century. We gave away most of the licenses to white men who are already well connected in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and to dig out of that hole is something that we all have to focus on.
And now, a guest commentary by Free Press Communications Director Craig Aaron.
The Consumerist blog recently set up a contest to determine America's worst company. The tournament's still going on, but I'm not afraid to predict the winner. It's going to be Comcast in a rout. How do I know? Well, first of all, because Comcast is the worst company in America. And I know what you're thinking. What about Walmart, Exxon, Halliburton? And I'll admit that I can't yet tie Comcast to child labor, environmental destruction, or even Dick Cheney. But clearly you've never sat around for 7 hours on a Saturday waiting for a new DVR. And I'm not alone in my seething rage for the nation's largest cable company. The internet is filled with sites like ComcastMustDie.com and ComcastSucks.org dedicated to the company. And then there's Mona Shaw. This once mild-mannered retired nurse from Northern Virginia, a square-dancing Unitarian, no less, got so fed up with Comcast's lousy customer service that she went down to the local office armed with a claw hammer. Here's how the Washington Post described it. Shaw storms into the company's office. Bam! She whacks the keyboard of the customer service rep. Bam! Down goes the monitor. Bam! She totals the telephone. People scatter, scream, cops show up. And what does she do? Pow! A parting shot to the phone. Now, awful customer service is one thing. But what's truly frightening are Comcast's plans for the future of the internet. Comcast is one of the leading opponents of net neutrality, the fundamental principle that prevents service providers from discriminating against websites. Comcast has long claimed that net neutrality is just a solution in search of a problem. Well, here's the problem. Last fall, the Associated Press caught Comcast secretly blocking popular and legal peer-to-peer file sharing. In response, Comcast denied it. Then they claimed it was just, quote, reasonable network management. The FCC held a hearing at Harvard in February to investigate, but Comcast was so afraid of public scrutiny that it hired seat fillers to crowd out the public and applaud on cue. But the ploy backfired in a big way. Net neutrality might be complicated, but everybody knows a dirty trick when they see it. If the FCC and Congress don't act quickly to stop Comcast and restore net neutrality, we may have to take matters into our own hands. Two words. Hammer time. Go with the phone. It is said if you can't rule the list, you probably are dead. So
wave your hands in the air. Bust a few moves. Run your fingers through your hair. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net. Can't touch this. Look, man. Can't touch this. You better get a hype, boy, because you know you can't touch this.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest Norman Solomon, the author of 12 books, and we're going to be talking about the most recent book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. Norman Solomon needs no introduction, I suspect, to many of the listeners. He's been a frequent guest on the show. In fact, graciously joined us just a couple weeks ago on the Pledge Drive show to say a few words. He is a long-standing journalist for decades now who's been covering politics in the United States and worldwide. His work can be found many places. He's also the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a group for which I proudly have served on the board for many years, for full disclosure here. With no further ado, let me welcome Norman Solomon to Media Matters.
Hey, thank you, Bob.
Well, it's great to have you back, Norman. And again, as I like to say on this show, one of the real nice features of doing this program every week on WILL AM 580 is that I oftentimes get to read books. And because I have guests coming on, it sort of gives me a chance to read books I might not have time to read otherwise because my life's fairly hectic. And this was one of the real pleasures for me to read, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, partially because you and I are roughly the same age, so I've lived through many of the experiences you chronicle here going back to the 60s, but also because I think you tell a great story. It's really it's easy to read. It's a page-turner, as they say.
Oh, well, thanks. You know, I'm really in the process of working on the book and talking about it, been struck by how our media and political culture really mitigates against us seeing so many intersections between history in the macro sense and our own personal life histories. And quite often, I think the notion that, well, the personal is political and vice versa is commonly or widely seen or propagated as being a sort of a, you know, mechanistic, politically correct idea. In point of fact, you know, from healthcare to war to pollution, our lives are just so affected by the politics and the historical era that we're living in.
Absolutely. And, you know, the book starts off, I thought, tellingly, after a very nice foreword by Daniel Ellsberg, the book starts off with the discussion of nuclear power, nuclear energy, nuclear weapons. And, you know, it was striking to me as I read this because, you know, we've had these debates in the United States, and you more than anyone, I think, have, as a journalist, have really chronicled this discussions of Iraq and now Iran, whether they have nuclear weapons and are a threat to the United States. And as I read Made Love, Got War, I couldn't help but be struck by how oblivious most Americans are to the fact that we are the overwhelming nuclear power of the world.
Yeah, I really didn't want to even write about it in some ways because who wants to think about hydrogen bombs and vaporization of humanity? And yet, although I haven't done this exercise, I'm confident of the results. If one were to go to Google and type in, say, U.S. nuclear weapons as a phrase, and then Britney Spears, asymmetrical result would come in. And we've sort of deep-sixed in our consciousness, our awareness of just the U.S. arsenal of, if you add the stockpiled and deployed at the ready nuclear weapons, about 10,000 of them, you know, to destroy the planet many times over, you know, Russia likewise. And somehow this is just more than ever, maybe since 1945, been pushed off the political and media maps.
It seems like since the end of the Cold War, when there was the sense that there were two nuclear powers staring each other down and that any sort of conflict could, you know, possibly deteriorate to nuclear weaponry. Now, since there is no other equal nuclear power, the sense is that's not really a chance that's going to happen now.
I remember being in a TV forum in San Francisco soon after, well, in around 1990, and when I raised issues by comparison with the sort of classic questions of economic conflicts between the haves and have-nots, I was told, and in these were the words, "Don't you know the Berlin Wall has fallen?" And in a parallel way, I think there's been a sort of dismissive concept, and maybe people in understandable terms just don't want to have to think about it anymore after the decades of the 40s through the 80s, with the question of nuclear weapons. And so it's just kind of like that's old hat. We've moved beyond that, maybe parallel to the idea that history ended. Well, gee, you can really see how economic class issues are gone from the planet, you know, or for that matter, issues of nuclear weapons. They're really there. They're with us, whether we acknowledge them or not.
And it's even more than that, as I read your book, Norm and Solomon, because, you know, I think most Americans think, and we certainly would like to think, that, you know, our leaders, our military, you know, can be trusted with these weapons. They're responsible. We're a democracy. We're not going to be the ones to ever use them. We really only need to worry about other people having them who don't have our values and our democratic mechanisms. When I read your book, I'm not really all that confident that we should be so self-assured. And I also get a sense that people in other countries of the world have no reason to be so confident that they can trust us either.
Yes, well, Daniel Ellsberg's introduction is so chilling because he knows of what he speaks. He's been really focused on nuclear weapons issues since the late 1950s, has worked at the Pentagon and the RAND Corporation and elsewhere, really looking at this. And he says point blank in the introduction that the idea of deterrence as the cornerstone of U.S. Weapons nuclear deployment has been a myth, that it's never been about deterrence. It's been about the United States wielding the prerogative and the threat, avowedly in foreign policy doctrine, to be the first to use nuclear weapons, even against a non-nuclear state. And that involves if the U.S. feels that it's in a militarily disadvantageous military confrontation that is eroding from the Pentagon standpoint, always retaining the strategic doctrine to be able to use nuclear weapons first to destroy, even decades ago, hundreds of millions of people, now several billions of people. That's always a weapon, an arrow in the quiver of the man in the Oval Office. And we also have the terrible reality that the United States, for all the talk of the democracy, is the only power to have used nuclear weapons twice against cities. The historical argument, you know, can be waged about whether it was necessary. I think the documentation, as Ellsberg has pointed out, is that it was not necessary to save lives, American or others. And I point out in the book that from the outset of the nuclear age, as it was publicly revealed, the President of the United States rested the foundation, the edifice, the mentality that was built about U.S. attitudes to nuclear weapons, based on falsehood. President Truman, in announcing the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, said that Hiroshima was a military base. And I think that is an indicator of the kind of candor we've gotten about the true aims and moral thresholds that the U.S. foreign policy establishment has in terms of use of nuclear weapons.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Norman Solomon, who you've just been listening to. He's the author of the brand new book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, just published. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Norman Solomon, the number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And for those of you not familiar with Norman Solomon, he is a newspaper columnist and journalist who writes widely on politics, American and global politics. And I think any question is fair game for Norman Solomon. Norman, the actor Richard Dreyfuss, in an interview many years ago, I remember it well, was asked about what it was like growing up in the 60s and how it compared to later times. And he said in the 60s, especially the mid and late 60s, it seemed like time moved so slowly that the changes that took place in the world and in your life in just a matter of 3 or 6 months are similar to what would take place in a decade later. And your book starts in the 60s. You came of age in the mid-60s and late 60s politically. And though quite young and precocious, I think, compared to most folks, you were very much involved in it, even as a teenager. today, you know, when you talk to people, especially young people who weren't there, what do you think the biggest misconceptions were, misunderstandings were of the late 1960s?
That everybody was opposed to the war if they were under 25, and the parallel notion that everybody was involved in, conscious, avowed, countercultural pursuits. And while, yes, we had a lot of people who were in their teens and 20s and older for that matter, but especially younger cohorts who were very active in the anti-war movements and so forth, they were still a minority. I mean, even when you had in one day a million people in 1969 in the fall marching near the White House against the war, just numerically, it's fairly small. And it's an unfortunate reality even of our culture in the best of times, one might say, that passivity is still a sort of a virus that gets replicated, reinforced by messages through media and sort of the drowsy-inducing political rhetoric that spews forth from people in positions of power. And I think that misconception then makes people feel sometimes now, well, gee, we just never will hit that high bar of the 60s because few people seem to be involved actively compared to the entire population.
In one section of the book, you have a funny or depressing, depending on the mood one's in when they read it, a discussion of how when you were, I think, only 17 or 18, you went to a meeting of what was, I think, SDS or some student activist group on a college campus. And this is like 1968, I think. And it just sounded like some sort of zoo almost, with people hollering and screaming at each other. And at one point, if I'm not mistaken, some people brought in a list of sort of Marxist slogans, dogma, and had numbered all these things that people were using and just shouted out the numbers sort of to mock the tenor of the debate. And I think the new left in a lot of people's minds has gotten that rap, that it was basically, you know, young kids out of control, dogmatists who didn't really know what they were doing and were on huge ego trips. How accurate do you think that is from your experience?
Well, I think it was a mixture that, as is so often the case, personalities and particular moments have a blend of a lot of different factors. You know, the ways in which we're often encouraged to put movements or individuals on pedestals really doesn't allow for the human complexities, whether it's a leader even like Martin Luther King, one of certainly the greatest Americans ever, or specific movements that were heroic, the civil rights, anti-war movements. These were not just unadulterated achievements of great nobility. We're human beings. We fall prey sometimes to all kinds of nonsense. And I think in the case of Students for a Democratic Society, in the particular meeting I was at, it was in Lexington, Kentucky, in, as you say, early 1968, SDS was really the fruition of a lot of the best of the new left because it moved beyond dogma. It didn't only talk in very rigid terms about, you know, classic notions of Marxism. We talked about Marcuse and other great theorists. We drew on our own experiences. We had a relationship between theory and practice that improved both and solidified and ossified, if you will, neither. And yet, the example you're talking about was an instance where people were understandably repelled at some points by not so much the new left in this case, but the reemergence of some of the not-so-nice and not-so-uplifting characteristics of the old left, the ideological rigidity and the rhetoric. Unfortunately, I mean, I think you could make the argument that the new left began to founder because of factors including a sort of a belated attraction to some of the rigidity of the old left that the Port Huron Statement in the early part of the decade, written by Tom Hayden and others founding SDS, had really moved away from.
Our guest, Norman Solomon, here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. And I want to work through the story because it's a great story, but you raise a lot of issues in the book dealing with contemporary politics. The book really points very much to the present day, and you've written widely on Iran and Iraq books, several of them. You've been on the show and talked about it. You talked about your film. And one of the things that struck me as I was reading the book was your discussion of Nixon and Kissinger and the bombing of Laos, and the attitude they had in the last few years of the Nixon administration about how no matter what happened in Vietnam, they were just going to, and I don't want to use profanity on there, but they were going to bomb the you-know-what out of North Vietnam, so that country would not exist if they could help it. And what struck me as I read that, and I don't think it was purely a coincidence, I think it was intended, you can tell me if I'm right, was how much that's the current attitude toward Iraq and the people who run this country, that they've sort of just really have this sort of ego thing almost, it sounds like.
Absolutely. It is a parallel that I think the last few decades really keeps reasserting in the real world, to whatever extent we recognize it and talk about it. U.S. foreign policy and those who run it, very much now, as it has been, predicated on a profound belief in violence. That is the holy grail of the presidency in terms of foreign policy. When you look at not the rhetoric, of course, but the actual behavior. And it's really parroted by many pundits, often with flowery terms. But in the book, I quote George Will, who wrote a few months after the invasion of Iraq, that yes, there would be some ugly and not uplifting scenes, that U.S. troops in Baghdad and elsewhere would be kicking in doors and engaging in some pretty unsightly activities, as he put it. But George Will went on to say that the first responsibility of government is to establish a monopoly on violence. And I think that is what is the currency of belief, the attitude that holds sway in high places. If you got the Pentagon under your command, it's a tempting outlook. If you were running, say, the government of Belgium in 2008, you might have less of that view, although if it was back at the beginning of the 19th century and you were talking about Congo or the Congo or something, it might be different. But this belief and this capacity to use that belief for massive violence to get one's way has really created the sort of the idolatry of these weapons, including weapons of mass destruction. And that has, you know, terrible results and helps explain the momentum, I think, for the continued occupation of Iraq.
How do you think, Norman Solomon, as you look at this 2008 presidential election, how do you think issues of foreign policy, U.S. role in the world, the role of the military, have been handled so far by the major candidates and by the news media?
I don't think they've been handled fairly or very well. The McCain candidacy, I think, is in a grim way forthright, and he is, I think, a believer in the maximum amount of violence necessary to establish and maintain one's goals. I think it was von Clausewitz, the military theorist, who said that every conqueror is a lover of peace. And, of course, he was being quite ironic. And I think while all of the advocates of continuing the war in Iraq full bore, as McCain is one of them, really do believe that as long as they can subdue resistance, they're all for peace. But to the extent they can't subdue it, they believe in maintaining that sort of full throttle war machine from the U.S. exerted in Iraq. I think Hillary Clinton has been just remarkably duplicitous in terms of the way that she's tried to justify in torturous ways the rationale for her vote to go to war in the fall of 2002. And I should say, full disclosure here, that just a few days ago in the congressional district where I live in California, I've been elected as an Obama delegate to the Democratic National Convention. So I did want to note that. Obama, though, I am not by any means happy with his position on the war. There are a lot of loopholes that he's left in it, including keeping a lot of mercenaries with money from tax dollars funneled through outfits like Blackwater in Iraq. And so I think there's a lot of room for change to move Obama, to my perspective, in a more constructive anti-war direction.
Do you think Hillary Clinton, from what you can see, is closer to McCain or to Obama on how she would handle Iraq were she elected president?
I think she's rhetorically closer to Obama, but I think her behavioral history indicates that she's probably situated more evenly between. She's left so many loopholes in terms of saying, you know, I'll begin within a couple of months of inauguration to withdraw troops. She's really avoided making a commitment. She has baited Obama by saying that, you know, you don't want to honor your enemies by sitting down with them. And I think that is an appreciable difference. It's a fight that she has chosen to pick with Obama, he has said, and I'm quoting here, "I don't want to just end the war. I want to end the mindset that got us into war." And he's also said, quote, he wants to meet not just with our friends, but also with our enemies. And that's from, you know, Iran and Syria to Cuba. And meanwhile, Hillary Clinton has actually attacked those statements as a sign of naivete.
I didn't realize you were a delegate for Obama. I guess congratulations are in order as your political career moves forward, Norman Solomon. If you'd like to call in, listeners, and talk with Norman Solomon, the number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Norman Solomon is the author of the brand new book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. It has a foreword by Daniel Ellsberg, and it is one of the most enjoyable reads I've had on this show in the 6 years of doing Media Matters. And while we're on the presidential race, let's just talk a little bit more about it, because one of the things that was striking in the last couple weeks was that former President Jimmy Carter visited Hamas leadership in the Middle East and came under, I think, striking denunciation from all the presidential candidates, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
And you write in the book, and the reason I raise this is you write in the book a very lengthy passage you include from 1982 when Israel invaded Lebanon, and you wrote about your experience as a Jew and, you know, how you wrestle with how do you deal with Israel. And it seems that, you know, this the criticism of Israel is virtually just off limits in our political culture, almost more than any other issue.
To me, from my own moral universe and what I believe to be genuine progressive principles, one of the bedrock principles has to be that human rights is indivisible. And so in this case, the life of a Palestinian or Israeli or Lebanese child has to be seen of equal momentous worth. And meanwhile, the whole notion of a single standard of human rights has to be a basis for journalism and political discourse also. And that stuff is kind of knocked into a cocked hat, as the saying used to go, when it comes to the U.S. national media and political discourse, such as it is, about Israel and the Middle East. And the result is you have this very convoluted set of precepts put forward so that the Bush administration, with largely support from the news media, say that the policy is to try to establish democracy in the Middle East. And I see this frequently on front pages in news reports in journalistic voice with no attribution whatsoever, as though it were some sort of objective fact that the Bush administration is seeking democracy in the Middle East. And yet, what everybody concedes was an election that reflected the view of the electorate. Hamas was elected in Gaza, so now they are unacceptable and you can't talk to them. And I think that is just another horrific example in how this entire discussion of the Middle East is created as a sort of a labyrinth of duplicity and almost Orwellianism quite often compared to what we need in terms of straightforward politics on those issues.
I'm reminded in 2000 of the presidential debate between Gore and George W. Bush, and then issue of the Middle East came up, and they both said they wanted to be peacemakers there. And Gore said, of course, the United States will be the peace broker in the Middle East, but no matter what, we'll always stand behind Israel.
Yeah, right. And I mean, brokers, it may not be the best metaphor. Are we talking about, you know, hedge funds and so forth, and all ways that behind the scenes the brokers are very far from honest? I think this is definitely the worst sort of realm. There's no worse in terms of looking at the two-party system and how it's functioning in the presidential race when there is no substantive difference in terms of policies towards Israel.
Our guest, Norman Solomon. You're listening to Media Matters. This is WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the book now, Norman, and just talk a little bit about some of the narrative in there. You talk in the book quite a bit about the 70s and sort of the transition that America went through really right at the end of the 60s, starting into the 70s, and sort of the increased depoliticization of life. What was that like?
For me, it was somewhat disorienting. I think that the Ford and then Carter eras were times when people were transitioning, but it was unclear into what. And there was a sort of reversion, I think, to a lot of the mass culture. I think of the metaphor of the billboards I saw, the Peter Max designs, which were identified in popular notion as being psychedelic, had been used for recruiting people into the U.S. Air Force. And that's just a bit of a metaphor for what was going on. At the same time, below the media radar, there was a lot of infrastructure being built, some community non-commercial radio stations, health clinics, food co-ops, legal aid society organizing, and a whole host of ways in which people were hunkering down for the long haul. I think, unfortunately, that involved, among other things, leaving electoral politics to others, often Democratic Party hacks, as well as, it turned out, the right wing. And the rise of Reagan was largely, I think, enabled by default. People on the left just figured it was a waste of time, too corrupt. And so while, you know, I think of the satirist Tom Lehrer, who had a song about the Spanish Civil War. He said, we may have won all the battles. No, how do you say it? They have may have won all the battles, but we had all the good songs. And in a sense, in the 70s, the counterculture, the left, had the good songs, had the cultural infrastructure that we were building, but the political battles were increasingly being won at the electoral level by the right wing.
And how did you, during the course of the 70s, become a journalist?
Well, it was really that I couldn't get away from it for very long. When I got out of high school, I worked full-time for a little while for a very mainstream weekly on the East Coast. And then after my rather abrupt exit from college in the middle of the Vietnam War in the early 1970s, again, I did a lot of freelancing. So even when I kind of set journalism aside and engaged in activism, sooner or later I would realize, hey, I have some skills that come under the heading of journalism. I had to use them. And so thanks to just two wonderful editors at the Progressive magazine, based, of course, in Madison, Wisconsin, Irwin Knoll and Sam Day, I got to travel to places like the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State and learn firsthand what was involved and then write it up. And so that enabled me to sort of keep recycling back to my journalistic skills.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Norman Solomon, author of the brand new book, Made Love, Got War. The phone number here again, 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Let's start with line four, the toll free line. Connecticut, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hi, how are you today, guys?
Hi.
I'm going to ask you, I've been listening to the media and the punditry and how they compare Obama and Hillary Clinton with John McCain, and often they give McCain, automatic leverage and know-how because he was in the military, and it seems like they reduce foreign policy now to defense policy. You know, foreign policy is not just defense policy. Foreign policy is diplomatic, economics, political, and military, of course, and geopolitical concerns. I don't know. So it seems like the pundits these days are just reducing foreign policy to the military defense policy aspect. And I was wondering if you guys could maybe comment on that for me, and I'll hang up.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, Norman, I'll let you field this. And while you field it, if you could talk about how you think the press is covering the candidates in comparison to each other.
Yeah, well, I think Love Fest is a good term to describe the coverage of McCain. He gets a pass, it seems, these days on almost anything. And in terms of what is being put forward with U.S. projection of military power and use of it, I think the term military is even much more accurate than defense. That's what's equated with national security, not global warming or healthcare, education, but how many missiles can be pointed in the correct direction and the most militarily useful way to use troops. And diplomacy is seen as second tier in terms of importance. Obama and Clinton, I think, have sporadically gained media favor, but it was notable that a couple of days ago the right wing with a smile sort of nuanced columnist pundit David Brooks on National Public Radio said it this way. He said, 6 months ago I was in the tank with Obama, now I'm lukewarm. I think that's very symptomatic of what's gone on, and I don't think that he or much of the media now are lukewarm. They're coming after Obama with knives, and I think it's notable they're doing it often in concert with the Clinton campaign and almost always attacking Obama from the right. You know, Karl Rove was renowned from his playbook of going after people with the three G's, God, guns, and gays. And the media and Hillary Clinton have not gotten to gays, at least not yet in terms of Obama, but guns and God, and of course the flag pin lapel and all the rest of it. These are classic right-wing attacks, and there's sort of a pincer move that has been taken against Obama from the Clinton machine and from the media to a large extent.
Now, the Clinton campaign, and I've actually been in correspondence with some of their strongest adherents in recent days, will claim that Obama's just getting the same treatment Clinton's been getting for the last year and a half from other Democrats and from the media, and that it's really no great difference. Do you buy that?
Overall, I don't. I mean, we can find instances where Hillary Clinton has gotten bad press, and certainly from the vast right-wing conspiracy, as she called it, you know, the right has been hostile, but then they went soft on her when they thought that Obama would be nominated. You know, notoriously, we had Rush Limbaugh urging his listeners in Texas and elsewhere to vote for Clinton. There's still some of that going on. So everybody has their complaints, but I think that overall, certainly in recent weeks, the news media had pumped up Obama. There was Obama mania. Now the mania has turned to hostility, I think, to a very large extent.
Our guest today, Norman Solomon. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hi. I wanted to bring up the most dangerous thing to talk about on this show is, I don't know, National Pentagon Radio was a very influential article. You know, I saw it on Common Dreams, and I had the same reaction you did to, I forget what journalist it was on the ground, reporting back that Maliki has stood up and it's a job that just had to be done, this vis-a-vis the attack on the army forces in the south, and then afterwards. Kennedy asked if Cheney had spoken with Maliki about this matter, and the two correspondents, he didn't ask Cheney directly, obviously, but the general and the ambassador who were on the Hill recently both just sort of demurred and said, well, not while I was around. And it seems to me that we're still getting that sorted out. It looks like Maliki may have been, I guess it's Gareth Porter's article suggests that Maliki was trying to prevent a large-scale attack from U.S. forces. So I wanted you to comment on that, and I guess I'll abuse my privilege and have a couple of other items, too, and that is the proxy war on the across the Iraq-Iran border. It's gotten some coverage in the L.A. Times just recently again, but it is just, you know, it was raised on a front-page story. I still remember the day on the front of the New York Times, October 23rd. Maureen Dowd wrote a column that referred to that article the following week, and this is about this PJAC force, the brother army of the PKK, who are you know, good Kurds, as opposed to the bad Kurds being. You can sort that out if you would.
Yeah, no, that's these are all key things, I think. Well, let me try a little bit. Hopefully to do justice first. It was a morning edition report on NPR in late March, and in her own voice, one of the NPR correspondents in Iraq said just point blank that the attack on Mahdi Army forces led by, at least initially, the Maliki government had to be done. And I think that sort of stuff just is routine and rarely raises eyebrows. In the Warm and Easy film, based on my book of the same name, I comment on the reality that in the basic conception of U.S. mass media and what we call journalism, or what is usually called journalism, to be pro-war is to be unbiased, but to be anti-war would be seen as biased. And so when you have Michael Gordon a week after the midterm elections in mid-November 2006, doing a front-page article about how experts, in his word, are saying that you can't quickly withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq, that it would be a big mistake. And then he goes on CNN, as he did a few hours later, and says that point blank, the U.S. should not withdraw troops from Iraq through his own journalistic voice, and nothing happens to him, and he's still on the beat 18 months later, that tells us something about the way in which the normal background radiation, so to speak, of journalism is to internalize the outlook from the White House and the Pentagon. So anyway, I'd say that about the kind of reportage we get across the board from so-called mainstream media. You know, very quickly, proxy war in Iran, Iraq, there's an ethos, an assumption of U.S. media coverage that it's absolutely reprehensible and wrong and should be accused, and then there should be a policy change forthwith from Tehran for Iran to send bombs into Iraq. That's our job. That's America's job to send bombs into Iraq. How dare Iran do that? And I think that tells us a lot about the mentality of the journalistic judgment that we get. And here's one more point. We've had for decades the journalistic assumption that there are important Kurds who matter and unimportant Kurds who don't matter. The Kurds who are being slaughtered in the 1980s, and it's the 90s, and some might argue still today in some context, in Turkey, they're insignificant Kurds. Their humanity doesn't matter because the Turkish government is aligned with Washington, end of story, whereas I think we've heard a few times that Saddam Hussein slaughtered Kurds and harmed his own people in that way, and the double standard is rather breathtaking.
Norman, you've written a lot specifically about Iran. It's been you've visited there. You've followed Iranian politics as closely as almost any American journalist has, with only a couple of exceptions. And, you know, what is your take on U.S.-Iranian relationships now? What do you think, from your observations, the U.S. government would like to do with regard to Iran? And how well is the media covering this issue?
Well, my sense is that Washington and Tehran keep circling each other like maybe two wary tigers in a cage, and they are meeting at times. There's back-channel communications, but this is in the context of what I think of an axis of fanatics, the most right-wing, if you will, elements of both countries, Ahmadinejad and the Bush-Cheney folks, who boost up rhetoric against each other to shore up and justify their own policies and reliance on military spending, for one thing. I think with some rare exceptions, which have involved some very good, nuanced reporting from Iran and the U.S. media, on the whole, it's a very a monochromatic view of a repressive society, and so we don't get a sense of the reality, which is that there's just a huge amount of politics that is internal to the country. There's a civil society that is somewhat vibrant, albeit with some repression. I was just very struck, having been in Iraq three times before the invasion under Saddam Hussein, what a police state it indeed was compared to being in Tehran and 2005 and seeing how much civil society really is functioning there.
Our guest, Norman Solomon, author of the brand new book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. We've got another 20 minutes or so if you'd like to call in. The phone number here at WILL-AM580 is 333-9455. The toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. I am your host, Bob McChesney. Norman Solomon, let's, if we can, go back to the book, and because I want to talk about a figure that comes up in the book a couple times who was very prominent when I was coming of age in my senior year of high school, named Charles Reich, or Reich, I can't remember how you pronounce his name, who wrote a best-selling book called The Greening of America in 1970, and you talk about him then, and then, sort of to my surprise, he comes back in the book 25 years later. And I think it tells a lot about changes in our culture, political culture, media culture, the way he's handled it each time.
It was fascinating to me to go back and read his book, The Greening of America, which was such a smash and excerpt of The New Yorker and a bestseller in the very early 1970s. And I was so enamored with it at the time, as were so many people. And then to go back and read it and just see almost what a self-parody it was, the way in which we, and I would include myself, had these outlandish beliefs that you could kind of change cultures like changing hats, never to return to the old one once you had crossed that Rubicon. And he had this hierarchy of three stages of consciousness. And he said once you reach that high stage of consciousness, which is number three, you've gone over number two, which is sort of Kennedy technocrat liberal one. You get to three, which is just sort of the hippie countercultural enlightenment, and then you're there and you could never backslide, which I would say in the last few decades has been belied by experience. And he also had this notion that institutional change was the last thing to change, that it was really about consciousness.
So it's really like a green light to turn within and abandon political work.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I think could not have been more wrong. And institutional change is just so crucial and is in tandem with, and often I believe precedes, changes of consciousness, which are rooted in the material realities of how people can live, how they can earn a living, what their time is taken up with, what are the messages that come at them in the workplace from the mass media, and so forth. And then I was very struck, and by the way, having almost never heard his name on TV or radio, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name either, Reich or Reich, but anyway, Charles Reich, in his book a couple of decades later, it was called Opposing the System, and he had totally revamped his outlook to, I think, a much more realistic and wise one, in which he said, yes, what matters to us most in human terms is not about money, but the economic constraints and the power held in concentrated form through financial power constrains humanity's possibilities to achieve the flowering of what we do care about, nurturance, love, family, friends, community. And I think here we are in 2008, and we are struggling still with those central questions, the decades-long, now we might say more than half a century-long attack on the New Deal, and the way in which privatization, from the airwaves to the public square to transportation to the military, really is part of the right-wing agenda to democratize the democratic elements we've had in our own culture.
Well, what was interesting to me, too, is the way, I mean, I think he was a huge media hero when the book came out in 1970. He was everywhere. And by 1995, as you said, I didn't even know he wrote this book. I didn't know the guy was still around. And it just fell entirely into the memory hole.
Yeah, he was a goner in the 90s. It was a major publisher of his book, Opposing the System. And the book just fell like a rock.
Our guest, Norman Solomon. Let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 4, Effingham, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I am a supporter of President Carter's efforts in the Middle East, and I am no fan of Michael Gordon. But I think Mr. Solomon has really simplified Mrs. Clinton's stance on what she said about Obama talking with enemies. She didn't say that was wrong. She said for a new president, to immediately plunge into face-to-face conversation with major elements from the other side was wrong before you had any diplomatic intercourse. And I fought Mr. Obama almost immediately in the early debates when he attacked her for her vote on Iraq, but didn't lay a glove on Biden, Dodd, or Richardson. And then, actually, to me, as a follower of foreign affairs, had the gall to go after her on her vote for Iran resolution when he ducked it, and he knew full well other anti-war Democrats, war critics, like Levin and Jack Reed and so forth, had voted with her on that. And finally, we've got this issue of the media. How could he be unaware that MSNBC, Newsweek, Eugene Robinson of the Washington Post, Maureen Dowd, almost everyone but Paul Krugman, has almost anointed Obama to be president? Now, admittedly, he's getting heat from Fox and Limbaugh, but then we expected that. They didn't want McCain. But to pretend that the media has attacked Obama and suddenly not turned her into a caricature, I'm sorry, but I think that's absurd. I will hang up and listen to the answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Norman?
Yeah, well, thanks for those points. And I certainly would take your point that Obama got some very good press. Obama mania really does refer to what happened last year for him. At the same time, though, if you look at, say, the vote to designate the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization, that is a noticeable, recognizable, senatorial flagstone laid on the path to a military attack on Iran. And it was a vote very much in that context. It's a vote that Hillary Clinton took. She voted affirmatively, and Obama didn't. So I think that's on the record. As somebody who is very active in, along with many other people, trying to prevent the invasion of Iraq, and going to Baghdad three times and writing a lot about it and following the debate in Congress, her vote was a vote for war, and her efforts to, in retrospect, spin it a different way because the war has become unpopular and say that she was only giving President Bush the leverage to engage in diplomatic negotiations. I mean, I live near San Francisco. I will sell you the Golden Gate Bridge for a very cheap price.
Norman Solomon, we've only got a handful of minutes left. There's so much more I'd like to talk to you about. But one thing I want to ask you about is you've been involved with media criticism and with the group, the Institute for Public Accuracy, that you talk about in the book now for, you know, a long time, two decades at least. And what is your sense that mainstream news coverage, commercial news media, including and add in NPR and PBS, from the 60s to the 80s to today, has there been any perceptible change in your view in how they've covered issues of war and peace and the U.S. role in the world?
Well, the styles have changed, and of course the technologies such as 24/7 cable have certainly come to the fore. I think in essence there are bedrock principles or anti-principles, if you will, that are still in play. Window on the world, largely tinted red, white, and blue. A willingness to over-rely, often to an extreme, on official sources in the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department, and Capitol Hill. And I think the difference is much more noticeable at the grassroots in terms of skepticism that is hard won because of movement building, because of independent media outlets, because, dare I say it, radio programs such as this one, of which there are far too few, but the aggregate of people through radio, some limited access to TV, now the internet, published materials, periodicals, books, documentaries, that there has been, from the grassroots, a shift to some marked degree. And so I think it did make it possible for us to have literally millions of people who protested in one way or another against the invasion of Iraq before it took place, whereas it was years before we had six figures of demonstrations, over 100,000 people demonstrating against the Vietnam War after it had gotten underway.
What are the hopeful signs along those lines you see in the United States today? I mean, do you think we are seeing any sort of emergence of more popular politics, be it represented in the anti-war movement or in the Obama electoral campaign, or is it too early to say?
I think there is more of an emergence. I think it's manifested in a sensibility. You know, oddly, it's even manifested or reflected by the fact that you have someone like Keith Olbermann, who is very much willing to go on the attack against the corporate military establishment. That's a barometer that at the base, there's more of a constituency, and the finger-to-the-wind corporatists who run MSNBC realize that the right-wing poll numbers have tanked so badly that there's some sort of maturitarian market out there. You know, limited degree, do they meet it? But overall, I think that there is a consciousness manifested in a sort of an activism, the ecology of a movement, very widespread. We can see it on the internet. We can see it in a lot of communities. And to me, and again, I say this now in the last few days as an Obama delegate to the National Convention, Obama himself as an individual and as a candidate is much less exciting to me than what might loosely be called the Obama movement, and especially among young people and many others. There's a profusion of energy, and I think that's very important because it cuts against the activism, the passivism that gets us repeatedly into so much trouble.
And one of the things that occurred to me, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, Norman Solomon, is as I was watching the candidate debate, such as it was a few days ago, and I was talking to friends about, gee, I wonder if this will hurt Obama, since the first half of the debate was basically him being asked to answer for a number of bizarre issues where he could not have a positive answer to any of them. The best he could do is break even. Would this really hurt his popular support? And I was wondering how many people under the age of 30 or 35 even watch those debates?
I suspect that quite a few more watch it in renditions of excerpts on the Colbert Report or The Daily Show. I mean, I'm talking about people who are maybe just voting for the first time because of their age getting them to that point. But still in all, I think it sort of ripples through the culture, and the media skepticism is really one of the cards Obama is holding now, because there has been a, if you will, a front lash against just the Gibson Stephanopoulos ABC Disney assault on Obama, which was just sort of over the top in that so-called debate. And I think that's where media skepticism becomes a sort of a tangible political tool, even in the electoral arena.
Norman Solomon is our guest today in Media Matters. He's the author of Made Love Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. Is there a webpage folks can go to learn more about the book, Norman?
Yeah, they can go to madelovegotwar.com.
Okay, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I do want to ask you something. As I read the book, you're extremely well-read, and I think this book will not be popular with college admissions officers, because your lack of a college degree would not show up if one were to read this book. Who are the authors that have influenced you the most as you sort of come to your present position and understanding of the world?
Well, I think we can just stipulate that Robert McChesney is one of them. But also, I would say Noam Chomsky, very important. And now for 30 years, being able to read Chomsky, not by any means even most of his prodigious output as an author, but reading many of his books and interviews, I think he's been very important. And going back, media critics in the 80s, such as Edward Herman and Michael Parenti, really helped sort of whet my appetite for jumping into that soup myself.
And how about sort of broader political thinkers or even philosophical thinkers?
I would say broader politically, certainly Howard Zinn has been very important. I would say the novelist Steinbeck was important to me, The Grapes of Wrath. People who have written about social conditions, James T. Farrell, you know, Upton Sinclair, very important to me. Not only the Brass Check nonfiction, but a lot of his fiction, even, you know, Elmer Gantry, and just sort of that way of deconstructing what we often see as just a cultural reality, just trying to flip it over and like a rock and understand more what's underneath.
And lastly, Norman Solomon, what is your media diet? What do you consume to stay on top of the world?
Well, I try to consume what I think is often some of the most egregious excuses for journalism. New York Times, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, The News Hour with Jim Lehrer, you know, the best, I call it the best of the worst, in that there is some quality journalism, but way too much trust is put into it. But I also go to The Guardian in Britain, The Independent, The Observer, The Globe and Mail in Canada, and I like to go to a lot of websites that are potpourris, like Common Dreams or Alternet, so I can learn different voices and I can contrast and compare with the corporate media.
Thank you so much, Norman Solomon. I hear the band tuning up in the background. That usually means they want to clear me out of the studio to let someone else in here.
Hey, Bob, thanks very much.
It's been a real honor and a pleasure to have you. Our guest today has been Norman Solomon, author of the new book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, with a foreword by Daniel Ellsberg. I want to also thank Matt Kessler, who's been working the board today, WILL AM580, Andrew Boyle, my producer, who's always hard at work getting great guests like today's guest on the air with us. I'll be back next week with Patrick Coburn from an on-the-ground report on what's actually happening in Iraq. My name is Bob McChesney. I want to thank you all very much for listening to this show. See you in 167 hours. Today's broadcast.